And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matuta.
And it's good to be with you today. Yes, welcome to Hands-On Apologetics. You have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. I'm Gary Matuta, your host and sensei for this hour. And as always, we dive into the wonderful world of explaining, defending, and sharing the faith with confidence and charity. And it's good to be with you. Got an interesting show in store for you today. coming off a recent debate with a Muslim apologist, our buddy William Albrecht comes back to the dojo. And actually, we're going to talk about the very same thing he did on that debate. We're going to talk about whether the New Testament teaches the incarnation. So that should be very interesting. It's not a very common subject, but I think it's a subject that we ought to know. So it's going to be fun to have William back on and chat with us. Also, as usual, we have Defining the Fallacy, and Defining the Fallacy for today is called the Wishful Thinking Fallacy. So a fun title right there. And also Meet the Early Church Father. We're going to meet a document, not necessarily a person, and that is the document known as the Apostolic Constitutions. And you remember maybe a few shows ago, one of the Meet the Early Fathers was the Apostolic Canons. Well, this is part of the Apostolic Constitution, so those two go together. Why I didn't put them back, I have no idea. But nevertheless, we're gonna treat the entire thing, which is the Apostolic Constitutions, and it's great to be with you. Thank you for joining us, and if you want to be part of the show, give us a call at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. Love to hear from you. Or if you want to shoot us an email, just send us an email at questions@handsonapologetics.com. It's questions@handsonapologetics.com. And that goes straight to the dojo mailbox where I receive it and answer it immediately. Of course, you can always ask questions through the Virgin Most Powerful phone app. And people have done that. The only problem is sometimes I miss those. So it's always, I think it's better if you email me at questions@handsonapologetics.com. Just because I check it every day, I keep tabs with it. But the phone app questions, I don't always see. So just FYI, because I stumbled upon an awesome question someone asked off the phone app. And that's definitely in the dojo mailbox must do on the air one day. Pile. But, you are part of the program. So if you have a question, send it in. We'd love to have you. And it's always fruitful discussion. And as always, it's great to give our shout out to those watching watching and listening on social media, such as Facebook and YouTube. Hi, everybody. It's great to see familiar names. Couple new names I see. Ah, thanks, Beth. That's a beautiful emoji explosion right there. Appreciate it. Very Eastery, if that's a word. And also, thank you for listening on your radio. And by the way, I know that a lot of people aren't able to listen to the program live, but rather they listen via podcast. And just in case you have to go or there's an interruption and you really wanted to hear what William Albrecht had to say about a particular passage, you can always access not only this program, but all the programs we do here on Virgin Most Powerful through our website, which is virginmostpowerfulradio.org. All one word, virginmostpowerfulradio.org. And, you just go to the shows or our programs, you click down on the menu, click Hands on Apologetics or any of the other great shows that we give, and it's all there for you, folks. You can download it, you can share it. And by the way, now speaking of sharing is caring. So, please share us. Let people know about us. Like us on social media. Tell your friends about it. Maybe share a podcast if you really enjoyed it. We've had some really cool podcasts, certainly this week and over our whole show career. So we appreciate it. Spread the word. So let's see. Without further ado, why don't we jump into our Finding the Fallacy for today? That's right. I mentioned Beth. Isn't that awesome? Sorry, I'm being distracted. Finding the Fallacy is Wishful Thinking Fallacy. Wishful Thinking Fallacy. So if you're a wishful thinker, beware. You could be making a fallacious argument. So what is it? Well, it's when the desire for something to be true is used in place of or as evidence for the truthfulness of the claim. And so wishful thinking actually is more of a bias, you know, a bias in your thinking rather than a logical fallacy. It's because you desire the outcome so much that that becomes like part of your argument, part of the evidence. And because of that desire, you have to be careful that you don't overemphasize too much the positive evidence for what you want the outcome to be. But you also have to be careful not to minimize or dismiss or ignore evidence that could weaken that claim. And unfortunately, wishful thinking kind of does that. Like I said, it's more of a bias than a logical fallacy. But nevertheless, it's out there. It's out there in spades. You know, sometimes people think that because they have the conviction that something is true, that that in and of itself is proof of its truth. And, you know, I think that's a very dangerous position to be in, because we want to have evidence to support our faith. But, you know, our faith doesn't necessarily, it doesn't make evidence for the truth of the faith. The faith stands on its own. So there you go. That's our finding of the fallacy for today, the wishful thinking fallacy, and kind of a fun one. You know, usually on Fridays I do propaganda techniques, and actually this fallacy kind of fits within that realm of propaganda technique. Okay, let's move on to the Meet the Early Church Father for today. Like I said, it's not really a father or a person per se, but rather a document. It's known as the Apostolic Constitutions, written roughly around AD 400. Okay, and it's often titled as the so-called or pseudo Apostolic Constitutions, or the Constitutions of the Holy Apostles by Clement. Why is it? Because it's basically not a legitimate thing. It's more of a forgery or pseudo-pigraphical work. It claims to be from Pope St. Clement of Rome, when in fact it's not. Okay, so it's often called Apostolic Constitutions, or sometimes it claims to be written by Clement of Rome when it really isn't. It consists of 8 books, and it ends up being, and interesting enough, the largest extent collection of legislative and liturgical material of such an early date. So it is very valuable, especially, like I said, with church law and also with liturgical practices. Like I said, it pretends to be of apostolic origin. And it's written as if it comes from the pen of Clement of Rome, but it's actually a forgery. It's a forgery, and actually not a very good forgery. the name of Clement is more of a literary device, and it was done with the deliberate intention to deceive. But besides that, nevertheless, it is an interesting collection of information. The work is divided into 3 parts. The parts are from books 1 through 6. Second part is book 7. Third part is book 8. First part basically is a reworking of another document known as the Didascalia of the 12 Apostles, or perhaps you've heard of the Teaching of the 12 Apostles. That was written roughly around AD 200 250. So the first 6 books are essentially a reworking of that document. And the Didascalia basically centers around legal and liturgical matters in the 2nd century. For example, the Didascalia talks about fasting during Holy Week, whereas the Constitutions kind of update it and extends this to Lent for 40 days. In Part 2, which is the whole of Book 7, I know you kind of need a map to follow all this, but the second part is really another enlargement and updating of yet another early church father document known as the Didache. You might remember that. That was an apostolic father. It's a very early on. It's the first recorded I guess you could kind of say canon law of the church. It's basically church legislation. Very, very early on. Well, the second part of the Apostolic Constitutions basically expounds on it and updates the Didache. And then finally, in the third part, which, by the way, I should also mention, it talks about baptism, consecration of bishops and stuff. That's in section two. And the third and the most valuable part of work is the final book, book eight. In this third section, it deals with charisms and with ordinations and blessings and also with legal prescriptions. And then finally, there's a separate work kind of attached to it, which is known as the Apostolic Canons that we treated a couple of days ago. So there's lots of information, especially about the early liturgy of the Mass and also church law. So when was this written? When was the Apostolic Constitutions written? Well, in its present form, it can't be any earlier than the year AD 341. Way too late to be written by the apostles or Clement of Rome. because 20 of the 85 apostolic canons are extracted from the canons of the Synod of Antioch of that year, we know that it couldn't be any earlier than that. So probably the whole work was completed roughly around the year 400. So it's late, it's pseudepigraphical, right? But nevertheless, it does give us a lot of data about worship and the regulations of the early church, at least in the 5th century. All right, stay tuned. We'll be talking with Master Apologist William Albrecht after the break.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. And our guest is William Albrecht, who returns to the dojo. And William, if you aren't familiar with him, is an internationally known Catholic apologist and speaker. He's spoken throughout the United States, also Mexico, Europe. And he also is probably one of the most prolific Catholic debaters that I know of. I know he's debated well over 50 debates, not only with Protestants, but also with non-Christians and on a variety of topics. He has a fantastic website. Check it out. His website is called patristicpillars.com. That's patristicpillars.com, one word. And where you can access all his great writings, his research, his fresh translations, and also recordings of his debate. So you want to check it out, patristicpillars.com. William Albrecht, welcome to Hands On Apologetics.
Gary, my friend, always a pleasure to be on.
Hey, you are just coming straight off of a debate not too long ago, aren't you?
I sure am, and today's topic is very, very relevant to the debate I just finished having just a few days ago.
Great. Tell us about it. What was the debate? Who did you debate, and what was the topic around?
I debated a Muslim theologian and apologist from the Muslim Debate Initiative, and his name is Shadid Lewis, and we debated on whether or not Jesus is God. And, of course, he presented the popular and even presented some unique argumentation for the Muslim side, and I, of course, defended the deity of Christ. And it was a very, very lively debate, very, very a lot of fun, really, really a lot of fun. But really, the one thing that I did notice that was at the heart of the issue between us, and it is the crux, if you will, between Muslims and Catholics, really is the incarnation. Because Muslims do not believe that it was that the incarnation took place. They don't believe that it was possible. And they believe that that in turn would limit God. And as Catholics, of course, we say the opposite.
Yeah, because their doctrine of monotheism, the oneness of God, they kind of look at Jesus being the Son as like an addition.
Yeah.
Kind of making a plurality out of various gods rather than maintaining that that there's only one God.
That is very correct. And we have to also realize that they're at the time of Muhammad, when Muhammad set down the pen and paper, his particular theology, really, really Christianity, Catholicism, was the doctrine of the Trinity was very well known, and the doctrine of the deity of Christ was very well known. But if we read the Quran and we read what is said in there, we can tell that really Muhammad just was not very familiar with Orthodox Christian teaching, if you will.
On a number of issues. I'm just trying to think. You know, in a way, it's like it's not purely a Islamic thing, too. I mean, throughout church history, there's always been difficulty expressing the correct understanding of the incarnation.
Yes, yes. Very, very true. There always has been, really, there from the very beginning, from the very get-go, we have seen Paul, we've seen individuals like Ignatius, and later on individuals like Irenaeus and Tertullian, battling against the heretics that really attacked the core of the faith, which, as we know, the incarnation is a very, very key doctrine to our faith. It is taught very, very explicitly in the New Testament. And to claim otherwise really is just to really not have a good grasp of the Bible.
Very good. Yeah. Well, let's begin by settling our terms. What exactly is the incarnation? What do we mean by that?
Very good question, Gary. And whenever people ask me, what do we mean by the incarnation, I love to point them towards the compendium to the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And also New Advent, newadvent.com is a great website. I'm going to go ahead and read what they say in brief. The compendium says, God is truth itself, and as such, he can neither deceive nor be deceived. He is light, and in him there is no darkness, quoting 1 John 1:5. The eternal Son of God, the incarnation of wisdom, was sent into the world to bear witness to the truth, as John 18:37 says. New Advent describes it clearly and really, really in a great fashion by saying, by describing certain aspects of the incarnation of Christ. Mm-hmm. The incarnation implies three facts. One, the divine person of Jesus Christ, the human, and two, the human nature of Jesus Christ, which is very important, and we'll cover that today. And three, the hypostatic union of the human with the divine nature in the divine person of Jesus Christ. So as Catholics, and not just Catholics, as any Orthodox Christian would believe, we believe Jesus has eternally existed. He is God. He is eternal God. But he came down. He became man for our sake, and he suffered on the cross for our sake. So we believe him to be truly God, but he took flesh. He took on flesh and suffered on the cross for our sins. That is the heart of what the incarnation is.
Yeah, folks, you know, a handy rule of thumb is the divine praises. Blessed be Jesus Christ, true God and true man, you know. So when you're talking about the incarnation, you have to establish Christ as a divine person, the divinity of Christ, that Christ has a human nature, and that the union of the human and divine nature in the one divine person of Jesus.
Yes.
It's funny, you know, and throughout church history, it's like all the arguments centered around those three, right? Because some claim Jesus was divine, but in a kind of lesser sense, you know, even kind of like we share in the divine nature, maybe Jesus did. And then, you know, a lot of people forget, but the human nature too was a big stickler, wasn't it? Some of the earliest heresies were over whether Jesus was truly human.
Very, very good point. And that is particularly why we can see Tertullian's very strong language when he's defending the Eucharist. And that's why we can also see it in the Irenaeus. And not just them, even before them, we can see Paul. And really, as we talked about it last week, Gary, the whole message, the message of the gospel being the resurrection, the bodily resurrection of Christ, what Paul is telling us is that Christ truly came in the flesh, truly suffered in the flesh, and he truly rose in bodily form. And here's the funny thing, Gary. All those three points that I just listed, they're the heart of what the earliest followers, those that knew Jesus, they're the heart of the doctrine that they taught. And those three things I just listed, they are denied by Muslims. Yeah. And that, in and of itself, is very dangerous.
Yeah, yeah, very good. Well, let's go to the biblical evidence then. I know you probably would want to start with a little bit of a run-up from the Old Testament. So where would you go to establish the bona fides of the incarnation?
I love starting off at Isaiah 7, Gary, and really there's so much we can delve into when we go into the look at the Old Testament and then make the connection into the New Testament, the direct connection, by the way, because the New Testament authors hearken to these texts. But Isaiah 7 is such a wonderful text, Gary. It begins at verse 13, where I like to focus, where it says, "Then Isaiah said, hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary mortals, that you weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Look, the virgin is with child and shall bear a son and shall name him Emmanuel." And I'd like to add to that point for the people hearing in, Gary, we know that this text was not only important for the New Testament writers, but the early church fathers as well. This was a very, very key text.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so, okay, work us through that. What does this text tell us about the incarnation?
This text tells us a lot. First off, this text is telling us that a virgin will be found with child. And first off, that is very odd, really. If you're thinking about it, a virgin with child, and a virgin is going to bear a son? I mean, really, if you really look at it at its face value, you look at the text in the Septuagint, because that is what the New Testament authors are hearkening to, the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. If you read it and you break it down, correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, but isn't it a bit of odd language to say that a virgin is going to be with child?
Yeah, to say the least, right?
Yeah, very, very odd. But that shows you that it may sound like very odd language, but if you look at it, the Holy Family was not a normal family in terms of what we would look at of families to this day. They were a very unique, a very special family. That is why Isaiah 7 tells us a virgin is going to bear a son. And this text directly connects to what? Which virgin do we know bore a son? And we know that the Virgin Mary, Mary the mother of Christ, Mary the mother of our God, did bear a son. And that is why we believe in the incarnation. As early as Isaiah 7, those that remember the Septuagint wasn't, you know, it's not like Catherine sat down and translated this into the Greek. This existed well before Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John sat down and put their writings to paper. So this was written well before their time. This was an ancient prophecy, and it was fulfilled in Jesus of Nazareth when he came down in the flesh.
Very good. Yeah, so you have not only the humanity of Christ, that the virgin is going to bear a son, you know, a human son, but that his name shall be Emmanuel.
Yes, God with us.
Which points to his divinity.
That is correct, yes. So you've got the heart of the incarnation. Because remember, as you pointed out very eloquently, Gary, as you pointed out, what is the incarnation? We can't just focus on the fact that Jesus is in the flesh. Okay, you're right, he's in the flesh. But who is Jesus Christ? Remember, Jesus Christ is, you can't divide him up. He's two persons, one the divinity, one the humanity. No, Jesus was fully God and fully man. So the incarnation, the heart of that, you can find that teaching as early as Isaiah 7, and that is why the New Testament authors saw that as so key and so important, and that is why the early church fathers saw that as being very important as well.
Very good. Yeah, so if you're going to bring up Isaiah 7:14, there's also that other passage in Isaiah 9 that's often linked with that. What does that have to tell us about the incarnation?
A very, very good question, Gary. Isaiah 9, beginning at 9:6, starts off in it really, really eloquent passages, just a really beautiful text. It says, "For a child has been born for us, a son given to us. Authority rests upon his shoulders, and he is named Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His authority shall grow continually, and there shall be endless peace. For the throne of David and his kingdom, he will establish and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time onward and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this."
Very good. Okay, that's Isaiah chapter 9. When we come back on the other side of the break, William, why don't we unpack that and see what it has to say about the incarnation. Sound good?
Yes.
All right, listen to Hands-On Apologetics, folks. Stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, "I want my husband to be on fire for the faith." Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference, or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith, because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Master Apologist William Albrecht, who's coming fresh off a debate on the Incarnation. So I figured, hey, what better topic to talk about than the biblical roots for this? And William, right before the break, you were quoting Isaiah 9, which says, "For a child is born to us, a son is given to us, authority rests on his shoulders, and his name, he is named Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." What can you find in this passage that would support the Incarnation?
Yes, this passage is so, so important. And this is exactly why the early church, those so familiar, those closest to Christ, really hearkened to this so much. First off, a child is born to us. That is very key that we must recognize. And then when we look at the titles that are going to be given to this child, he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace, and his reign will have no end. It'll be eternal. Before we really unpack it completely, Gary, the one objection you would get from a Unitarian or a Muslim would be, look, you can't point to Jesus here because he's being called Everlasting Father. Really quick for those that are listening, Everlasting Father is in the term of Father of creation, not Father in the sense of God the Father. So this is a different, distinct person. This is a child that is going to be born. So this is something that is talking about an event that is going to occur in the future. So this would be somebody other than God the Father. And the titles that are given to this person will show, one, that he is Almighty God, Mighty God. His reign will have no end. He is eternal, and he's a child. He is human. That is so key to unpacking this text, that really, if we look at this, every one of these titles, Gary, what is incredible about him? They're talking about Yahweh. They're talking about eternal God.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, so folks, you know, a great way to remember this, if anybody ever challenges you on the Incarnation, just remember these two texts that are very frequently cited during Christmas. You know, Isaiah 7:14, virgin shall conceive and bear a son, his name will be called Emmanuel, God with us. And also Isaiah 9, you know, this is part of that wonderful movement in Handel's Messiah, that a son is born to us and he'll be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Beautiful. Very good. So there's roots in the Old Testament. Where would you go in the New Testament to show the Incarnation?
In the New Testament, I love to begin with John 1. John 1 has such beautiful imagery and is telling you something incredible. John 1 says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was made nothing that was made." So what we're being told here, first off, the Logos is Christ. And in the beginning was the Logos. He existed. And the Logos coexisted. The Word coexisted with who? With God the Father. And the Word, which is Christ, was God. So we're told something very significant here, aren't we, Gary?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so you have the distinction between the first and second person of the Trinity. Of course, this harkens back to Genesis, right, where God creates through his word. And, you know, when you speak a word, you breathe, you know, and you also have God's spirit there. You could actually see a kind of a trinity in Genesis 1. Yeah, very good.
Absolutely. Very true, yes.
So so the word is that which created all things, and nothing came into being that hasn't been made by him. Would you also include with that, and the word became flesh and dwelt among us? I think that's at 1:14.
Definitely, definitely. That is another fantastic passage, because really, what is that telling us? The word, we're told already, remember the word is Christ, Logos. Jesus Christ is the word. He is God incarnate. And when it says that he became flesh and dwelt among us, it is telling you that he took upon himself human flesh, and he was basically living, walking, and talking. He hungered. He thirsted. He talked. And this theology, this teaching, was put down by those that knew him the best, those that conversed with him, Gary, those that were able to sit down at the campfire and listen to his wonderful preaching. How incredible that must have been.
Yeah. So how would a Muslim or a Unitarian, how would they understand verses 1 through 3?
Unfortunately, a Muslim would really completely distort the text. They would take the Greek text and they would try to say that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was a God.
Which, oh, really?
Really.
Like the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Exactly, just like that. And as you look at Muslims today, the majority of Muslims will try to just completely disregard John, say that it was written much later, it isn't valid. But nowadays, you're running into Muslims that are really adopting portions of John, taking them out of context, and using them for their own theology. And when they do that, they then in turn adopt arguments that are popular amongst Jehovah's Witnesses, but really have no place in the original Greek language. And we know they don't have any place, Gary, because the very first people, those that knew Jesus, did not translate the text that way.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. I always wondered how they would look at that.
Yes.
Where else in John would you go for the incarnation?
Oh, man. One particular area that just blows me away, Gary, and I remember really studying it many years back, and it just blew me away. John 8. Really, okay. John 8 is so incredible. John 8 says, your father, in verse 56, your father Abraham, he's talking to the Jews here, and the Jews are really out of it. They want Christ just dead, basically. They're just... these particular Jews really don't like Jesus and the message he's spreading. Yeah. So he tells them, your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it and was glad. Then the Jews said to him, you are not yet 50 years old and you have seen Abraham? Jesus said to them, very, very truly I tell you, before Abraham was, I am. So they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, so how do you unpack that? What facts are implicit in here?
The one thing that we're told directly here, Gary, and the reason the Jews get filled with rage, is he's telling them, before Abraham was, I am. Mm-hmm. He is Almighty God, and they know any good Jew, even any bad Jew, because these are bad Jews. So any Jew at this period of time would have known who Abraham was. And they would have known the fact that God appeared to Abraham in the Old Testament. And God dialogued with Abraham, appeared as a man, hungered, thirsted, appeared as a man. So Jesus is telling them, your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. And then he tells them, he saw it and he was glad. And as soon as he tells them, as soon as they make that connection, they're filled with rage. Isn't that incredible, Gary?
Yeah, that's the episode of the three visitors.
That is correct. That is the episode. I believe, you might correct me if I'm wrong here, Gary, I think that was Genesis 18. I might be wrong on that.
Yeah, I think so. Yes. And if you look through it closely, folks, you find out that one of those visitors identifies himself as God. I mean, Abraham talks to him as Lord, you know, God in Hebrew is Yahweh. So William, what is the day? Jesus said, your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it and was glad. What was the day that Abraham was glad and rejoiced?
Yes, this is the exact day that we read about in Genesis 18 in the Old Testament, where Abraham actually saw Yahweh. And we know right here that when Abraham sees God, we know that the connection, well, we know now when Jesus said it, Jesus is directly saying he rejoiced when he would see my day, and he saw it. So what is Christ telling us? He's saying, hey, that was me. I conversed with Abraham. I came down as a man. That is something that is incredible. And the Jews understood exactly what day he was talking about, because Abraham was able to see it and was able to rejoice and embrace the fact that God had appeared to him.
Yeah, that's one of those passages that I think people get mixed up on, because it's almost sounds like somehow Abraham was in a time transporter and saw Jesus in the first century and rejoiced, you know. But he's actually referring to something that happened in Genesis to Abraham.
Yes, he is. And the Jews knew that. They knew exactly what he was talking to. They knew the text that he was referring to. And that is why the reason they get so enraged, so infuriated, and they truly believe this is blasphemy. But as we know, Gary, as Jesus said, destroy this temple and I will raise it up. They know. They found out later that when Jesus did resurrect, they found out that everything he said was indeed true, and he was not lying. He was truly God incarnate. He truly came in the flesh. But as we know, Jesus Christ has always existed, and before he came down, before he was born of a virgin, he conversed, he dialogued with their father Abraham.
Yeah, and just so in case they didn't get the point in verse 58, it says, before Abraham was, I am. He gives the divine name that God gave Moses at the burning bush, I am.
Correct, yes.
Which just so happens to be the same name that God spoke when he visited Abraham.
That is so correct, yes.
Yeah, I love that passage too, because that whole context, if he isn't talking about that visitation back in Genesis, then him using the divine name doesn't make sense. But when you put the two together,
it does.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're talking with William Albrecht about the incarnation in the New Testament. More on this to come, so stay tuned, everybody.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith, because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber.
Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. We're chatting with William Albrecht, master apologist, and also one of the most prolific debaters out there from the Catholic perspective. Talking about the Incarnation. And I know Terry Barber always wants action items. So, you know, action item is to memorize those three parts. What is the Incarnation? Jesus Christ has truly divine nature, a truly human nature, and the two natures are united in one divine person. So you remember that, you do well. William, you know, one of the most important passages I know scholars go to in terms of the Incarnation is Philippians 2. So can you read that for us and tell us a little bit about it?
Oh, definitely. And really, this is such an incredible text, historical text to go to. Really, here we read, Jesus emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness and being found in human form. He humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God also highly exalted him and gave him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bend in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father.
Very good. So you have the Jesus empties himself. Now, tell us a little bit about the background. What is, walk us through this.
Yeah, if you really look at Philippians 2, we know for a fact that Jesus Christ, when he took on flesh, we know that there was kind of an emptying, a solid kind of an emptying that went on, because we can read Jesus grew in knowledge. We read about that in the Gospels. We read that there's certain things that Jesus did not know in his human form, such as the hour. When will the hour come? We're told that only the Father knew that. There's certain things that we know Jesus was limited in his human nature. And we know this because he voluntarily emptied himself. Philippians 2 says he took the form of a slave. Now, of course, these things later on, as we read in Revelation, when Christ has returned to glory at the right hand of power, we know that he does know these things. In his human form, he was limited in a sense. So Philippians 2 says, he emptied himself for us to humble himself and become obedient and to die on the cross. And Philippians 2 is written kind of like a hymn. Scholars of this day like to call it kind of like a hymn of Christ. And it is a very, very important testimony. And it is a testimony that was not just important for Paul, but the early church saw this as crucial to the doctrine of the Incarnation.
Yes, yes. So he empties himself of divine prerogatives, becomes man, suffers death on the cross, and then he's exalted and giving a name that's above every name. Now, William, what's the name that's above every name?
That's a good question as well, Gary, because what you just did right there was you set up one of the most popular Jehovah's Witnesses arguments that can be put up. They love to say, and they won't go to Philippians 2. They'll go to another text. They'll say, well, the Father gave Jesus the name Yahweh. So Jesus has not always been Yahweh. So the texts that point to Jesus being Yahweh only show that the Father gave him that, but he's not eternal God. But guess what? Philippians 2 shows us the name Yahweh wasn't given to him. Jesus Christ has always been eternal God. But at the name of Jesus, every knee should bend in heaven and on earth and under the earth. So people listening, this is Hands-On Apologetics. Remember that the name Jesus was given to him, but he has always been eternal God.
Yes. Yeah, very good. Excellent. Well, you know, William, another common objection is that a couple of times in the New Testament, Jesus is called a man. And so they'll say, see, even the Bible, even Jesus himself refers to himself as a man. So how could it possibly be talking about the incarnate Lord?
Yeah, and that is an argument you're going to encounter from the Muslim Debate Initiative. The gentleman, Shadid Lewis, who is part of that debate initiative, that is an argument that they find to be popular. And that is also an argument you'll probably encounter from a Unitarian. And they will then hearken to biblical commentaries and the lexicons that say Jesus was described as a man. And they'll then say, look, what does Vine's Bible Dictionary, because that is a popular reference source, they'll say, what does Vine say about the Greek word for man? The Greek word for man, for those listening, is anthropos. And they point out and say, anthropos means generally a human being. Okay, look, Jesus is called man. He must be fully human and not God at all. Because even though a Unitarian, depending which kind you run into, may believe Jesus was God, they believe he was given that from God the Father. A Muslim does not believe Jesus is anything other than a man. They don't believe Jesus was God at all. So they will hearken to Vines or to any other reference list, such as Strong's or whatever. But the problem here, Gary, the problem that they're not telling you is that they're not only misusing these reference sources, they're abusing them. Vines says anthropos is used in distinction from God. That is correct. But it then uses passages where that point is applicable. Not all passages employ the word man to show a distinction from God. Furthermore, we believe Jesus was fully man, don't we, Gary?
Yeah, I was going to say, right.
Man. Yeah, we believe he was fully man. But here's the unfortunate thing, Gary. We have to go to these lengths of making the theological point even deeper because they will misuse and abuse a text to the point where they really just don't know our theology. And if we have to go to Vines to refute them or to any other reference material, we'll do it because Vines shows a distinction. But if you go down to section K for the word anthropos for man, it tells us there is an exception. The phrase son of man and anthropos lists son of man for a title of Jesus. And what does that tell us? That says he is revealed, Jesus, not as the person known by the title, but as the one who is qualified to act as the judge of all men. He is the same person as in the days of his flesh, still continuing his humanity with his deity. This serves to distinguish him as they're seen in his glory and majesty in contrast to the days of his humiliation. So even there, Gary, we see there's no problem when Jesus is called man. He's fully man and he is fully God.
Wow. Yeah, great. Great. Very good. Well, you know, we got solid scriptural basis for understanding the incarnation, and you're really just touching on kind of the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more you could go into.
Yeah.
But we also have the early church fathers, the earliest Christians. How did they understand Jesus? Did they understand the incarnation from, you know, the earliest times?
Great point there, Gary. And as you know, here on Hands-On Apologetics, I love how you always love to delve into the church fathers. And why do you do that? Because they are very important. They come from the time closest to Christ. And a number of these, not only did they hear Christ preach, But they knew those that knew Christ the closest. Ignatius of Antioch, he tells us, and this is one of the most incredible writings I've read, in his Epistle to the Magnesians, chapter 6, he says, the ministry of Jesus Christ, here's the good part, who was with the Father before the beginning of time, and in the end was revealed. Do all then, imitating the same divine conduct, pay respect to one another, and let no one look upon his neighbor after the flesh, but continually love each other as in Jesus Christ. Let nothing exist among you that may divide you, but be united with your bishop and those that preside over you as a type and evidence of your immortality. So what is Ignatius telling us, Gary? He says the ministry of Jesus, who was with the Father before the beginning of time, eternal God, like the Father, eternal God.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty much in your face, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
So if Jesus, so he's not denying the humanity of Jesus, right? He accepts the humanity of Jesus, yet in some way he also was with the Father before the beginning of time. So he's eternal.
Definitely.
Right.
Definitely, he's eternal. And to hammer home the point of the fact that he took flesh, when he's writing to Polycarp in chapter 3, Ignatius could not be any clearer when he says, look for him who is above all time, eternal and invisible, but yet who became visible for our sake. That says it all there, Gary. He became visible, and as Ignatius says, yet who became passible on our account, and who in every kind of way suffered for our sake.
Wow. Yeah, that's a very clear statement, about Christ's divinity and humanity. So Christ is above all, eternal and invisible, yet visible in time, able to suffer for our sakes.
Yes.
Excellent. Very good. Okay, so that is Ignatius of Antioch, who's an apostolic father. So he knew St. John. He was the third bishop of Antioch, very early Christian. Are there any other early church fathers who saw the incarnation?
Your listeners are in for a real treat, Gary, because we've got the Epistle of Barnabas. And if people have been hearing and following what we were talking about earlier, particularly in John 8, they're going to really like this. This shows a clear belief in a pre-incarnate Christ having existed eternally with God as God. And he tells us in chapter 5, he is the Lord of the whole world, to whom God set up the foundation of the world. Let us make man in our image and likeness. Then in chapter 14, this text tells us, Christ talked with Moses, and before the incarnation, received from the Father the command to redeem us.
Wow. Wow, what a great statement. Well, William, thank you so much for coming on the show. I can't believe the hour has just flown.
Oh, flies when we're having fun, Gary.
I tell you, great stuff. Well, thank you for coming on. By the way, folks, if you want to check out William's works, his writings and his debates, go to patristicpillars.com. You can find all his information there. Coming up next week on Hands-On Apologetics, we're going to have In the Dojo, Trent Horn, John Martinoni, Dr. Brian Bradford, and Roy Showman. It's going to be great shows in store for you next week. Coming up next, the dynamic duo of Catholic Talk Radio, the Terry and Jesse Show. A high-impact Catholic talk coming at you. It's time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center for the weekend, folks. Turn off the dojo lights. I wish everybody a happy and blessed weekend. Take care. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.